Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
It's time for True American Heroes, For the Record, with Jack Rutland. Another exclusive on Super Talk Mississippi 102.1 FM. Many of our heroes have taken their stories with them to the grave. But this show is about the stories and personal experiences of these veterans.
Welcome. It's an honor to have with me today Mr. Julius Sommer, who is certainly not a stranger to those of us from Lincoln County in Brookhaven. He's a Brookhaven boy, was born here, and served his country during World War II, and just been a friend of mine and someone I've respected in a great way for many years, going to church with him and seeing him around town and enjoying his friendship. But Mr. Sommer, it's an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you, sir. Great to be here.
Good. Well, let's just talk a little bit about your background, first of all. I mean, you did serve and wear the uniform of our country during World War II, but you were born in Brookhaven, is that correct, or Lincoln County?
Right, Lincoln County. I was born out in Fair River, the old Fair Oak Springs High School, went to school there.
Okay.
Through the 10th grade, transferred to Colin. I finished high school and junior college in Colin.
At Colin, that's right. Many folks don't know that at Colin actually had its own high school for a while,
right.
And then went right in. People could go right into the community college.
Exactly.
Okay, so you were born in Lincoln County, out at near Fair River, and went to school. Finished at Colin. Did you now? Where were you when you heard about Pearl Harbor? Do you remember that?
Yes, exactly. I was. When I actually heard it on Sunday, I was at home, and we had, at that time, we didn't have electricity. We had a battery radio, we heard it on the radio where Pearl Harbor had been bombed by the Japanese.
Now, this may be a tough question, but what time of the day did you actually, because I know there's quite a bit of difference in the time zones, so you probably heard it later in the day? I mean, do you remember that?
Oh, it was like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Gotcha.
Here.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Wow.
And so I went back to school, of course, Sunday night, back to Colin, and then the president declared war the next day on December 7th.
Wow. And you know, it's just about everybody I've spoken to about any of those types of events remembers exactly where they were, what they were doing when they heard the announcement.
Exactly.
It just indelibly stained on there or stuck to their mind and memory.
Yeah.
Well, all right, so you're at Colin, and then war's been declared. Now, how did you actually get into the military service?
Well, there had been a military buildup for some time before, but when the war broke out, when war was declared, it was really a tremendous buildup then.
Sure.
At that time, the restoration and the call to active service was 21, mm-hmm. age 21.
And how old were you?
And I was 17.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
But when war was declared, they immediately reduced registration to 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then they called 19 and 20-year-olds.
Gotcha.
And so I registered at 18. My birthday is September, and I had just turned 19 when the war. I was a young 19.
Mm-hmm.
And so immediately I had to register because all of the college degree men had been of draft age in that bracket were called in immediately for, you know, if you think about it, they had to have leaders
mm-hmm.
and somebody to control this tremendous influx of recruits coming in.
That's right.
So college men with a degree in that age bracket, which I think was up to 38,
mm-hmm.
and they were called in, and most of them went officer material, and they got in early. They stayed. Most of those guys came out high rank, like up into colonel, lieutenant colonels, and colonels.
Right, because they were in the start of the war.
Right, but if you think of it then, there was nothing left behind that in the way of further education to be leaders coming on. And so the government, the military, developed a reserve program where college students could sign up and join and continue in school to get some more education in following this group that was already. And so I was in that bracket, and I joined, volunteered, and joined the Army and was deferred from the draft to continue college, and that's how I went in the service.
Okay, okay. So when were you actually called to active duty?
Well, then I was signed at 19. I got draft cut notice that on my 19th birthday. That's when I was called. And then later, when all that was in, they dropped it back to 18 to call. But at 19, I got my draft notice, and I had just 2 days before gotten signed in the Army and got relief from the draft. So I stayed in school until March of 43. I got another whole year of college in that program, but then we were all called in blanket. There's 18 of us went from Cole Inn the same day.
You know, you just said something that made me remember also, part of our program is recognizing our veterans, especially our World War II vets in Korea and Vietnam and even the most recent conflicts. But a lot of what we do is we want people to realize we've got an unbelievable museum here in Brookhaven.
Absolutely.
And you've got a little, I call it a book that you put together about your service in the military, because it is so interesting. But I love your title, and the title of your little memoirs are Unlikely But True. Well, and I think, as I've heard over the years, you and I just chatting back and forth, there's an incredible sequence of events that happened while you were in the military.
Jack, people may not realize it would if you think. You know, it was said at that time, I don't know what the ratio would be now, but at that time it was said that for every combat person, military, in combat, finally it took seven back here to keep them back.
Supplies and manufacturing,
all these
That's
things.
Right.
And I was just blessed to be one of those seven, I guess. I just, every time I got right up to the points, it looked like something. But the things that just happened, followed no protocol, but it just happened.
It sounds like providence. Sounds like providence to me.
Exactly.
But it's just incredible, because I've read that book, and it's so interesting. But I wanted folks to know that there's items just like that in the museum about people that we cross paths with every day in Brookhaven and Lincoln County. And we don't need to forget the service that even though Mr. Summers didn't have to charge a beach with an M1. Right. Your role was just as important or significant, because just like you said, to keep those guys in combat, it took seven guys supporting. Critical role that you served in World War II. But your memoirs are just so much fun to read, and I would encourage people around the community to be sure they do that. Well, let's get on talking. You ended up being activated, and so where did you end up? Where were you training? Your basic was where?
Well, we of course went in and were inducted into the service in Camp Shelby. We got noticed to be at a certain place at a certain time to be picked
That's
up.
That's right. Sounded like the Army.
And it was, like I say, 18 from Cole Inn was in that same call. And so we went to Camp Shelby, and they assigned us from there. Interesting little thing. One of my blessings was that when we got in the line for assignment to what branch of service you would be assigned, when I got up to that desk, there were about six, seven lines. Outside, everything was in a line. And when I just said, get in the line and wait your turn. And so when I got up to the desk to be assigned a branch of service, my first cousin was a sergeant sitting at that desk to assign me.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, he was married to my first cousin, and Herbert Worley from Crystal Springs. And Herbert said, yes, we had our little thing, but Herbert said, Jerry, I can't put you in the Air Force. Air Corps it was then. That time, the Army Air Corps had just been changed to its own branch of service, the United States Air Force. Mm-hmm. And so the Air Corps was not drawing people from the Army anymore.
They were getting their own
through volunteer. Right. So he said, I can't put you in the Air Force, which is a place of choice, but I can put you in the Signal Corps, which is the next best place militarily.
Okay.
And so that's what we did.
And the Signal Corps is communications.
Yeah.
Radio right. operators,
and
things like that.
We were not an offensive troop. But we had defensive weapons and the training, but our mission was communications.
Exactly.
And so that was a bit of luck that most of the men I went in with, frankly, went into the infantry.
So you went. All right, so where did you go for a training for the Signal Corps?
So then I went from there to Camp Crowder, Missouri. And we went to Camp Crowder, Missouri. We got checked in there. And, of course, we had our routine forms, and you fill out forms and all that, and they read you about things. But then came assignment to what branch or what job assignment you would have in the Signal Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they had linesmen and radio operators and all. But we were told, my group said, well, you're lucky you have a choice. You can go to truck driver school, or you can be a cook. And I've wondered a lot of times if I'd chosen going to what it would have been had I been a cook. I like to cook. I do cooking. But I chose truck driver, having come off a pulpwood truck out there in the woods in Fair River. I thought, well, that's so I did, and that's how I got in. And so from there, we had 4 weeks basic, just Army protocol and those things. So then we went to 9 weeks motor transport school. After that, my class was assigned, class 413, was called to remain. Most of them finishing there, that 9 weeks training, went to tack outfits to build up for complete a unit for
overseas.
But my class, 413, was retained for service drivers for the camp. And we were called retained drivers. And so that's when we just, like going to work, we just drove where we were assigned and for time.
Okay, now that's I loved hearing these different things because I've never heard anybody talk about how all that process happens and how you ended up, because it's interesting the way that you were in the right place at the right time. And we're running down to the end of this, but I want you to define something. You mentioned the word cadre a while ago.
Yeah.
Tell us what that is.
Yeah, well, while we were retained drivers, I was out. I came in my motor sergeant, who was Sergeant Hutchison, an older man in his 30s, and just fine, wonderful guy, treated us like children that we were. And he came in, he said, I've got a notice here for you to report to the colonel's office. And Sergeant Hutchison, he said, and you know, it's bad news to be called to the big office. And Sergeant, he said, what?
And you weren't even a private then, were you?
Oh, no.
You were just a soldier.
And he said, what in the world have you done? I said, man, if I've done it, I don't know about it, but there's a lot I don't know.
So you go to the colonel's office.
We got over to the colonel's office, and he said, I want to point you, ask me a few questions about stuff, a little interview, light stuff. He said, I want to point you cadre.
Cadre.
And so I said to myself, what is cadre? I looked it up, and it just says in charge. But he said, we're going to have to give you a set of corporal stripes, so you'll have some authority over the men that you're dealing with. And I said, oh, I guess Mr. Smith said, no pay. This is acting corporal. You don't get it in pay. The ratings are frozen for the camp. So to speed that on, I was made cadre. I was assigned a cadre room back in the company where I lived. I was in charge of a platoon of men there, but
a platoon, which could be what, four squads, and that could be as many as 30 men.
It's about 60 to 65.
Okay, 60 men.
There's four platoons to the company.
That's right.
I was a leader of the third platoon, and that job carried immediately a buck sergeant rating. But I was a corporal with a private's pay. But I had the same duties as I did everything. No,
as a buck sergeant.
Yeah.
Amazing. But, well, this is like you said, unlikely but true.
That's true.
We've got to take a quick break, and we're going to be right back with Mr. Julius Sommer and hear some of these unlikely but true stories. Well, welcome back. We're just honored to have with us today Mr. Julius Sommer that we're interviewing here. A veteran of World War II, and a lot of unlikely events. And as a matter of fact, his little memoirs that he's graciously shared with the Military Memorial Museum here in Brookhaven are entitled Unlikely But True. So, I'm telling you, sitting here talking to Mr. Sommer's I wish we had about 3 or 4 hours, but we're going to try to squeeze all this in. Mr. Summers, now after you, you're a buck sergeant, that's three stripes, weren't getting paid for it, had all the responsibility, but no remuneration. But there were some events that we kind of chatted about, significant and humorous stories. There was one about an AWOL guard that you got up in the middle of. And then there were some other things about the WACS, and we'll talk about WACS, and also about second lieutenants. So tell me a couple of these stories.
Well, all right. It was a number of things happened during this tenure as cadre and stuff. Because we lived in the back, but our school was totally separate. We would get men out every morning and go to the school. But during that time, in the hottest part of the war, second lieutenants didn't last long.
Life expectancy
was
short.
Right in the middle of it all, because they were the platoon officer that called the orders. And so there became a shortage of junior officers. And they, three different times, I had the opportunity to apply for OCS. And they would come through the barracks, the mess hall, and announced that, and they were looking for seasoned, experienced soldiers, enlisted men that would go to OCS. And but I had a cadre room, had a private room, I had a Class A pass, I could go anywhere, anytime. With
it had three stripes on your sleeve, even though you weren't getting paid.
I had two stripes.
Oh, you just had corporal then?
Never did get a third, but two stripes as corporal.
You just had buck sergeant responsibility.
But I had freedom and good duty, and I just couldn't see the wisdom in volunteering to go to battle. But lots did. Well, to say that, it cycled back in then at one period during the time I was cadre instructor in this school. They became a surplus. From all of that, the war began to wind down a little, got deeper in, and the needs let off. They had put out more second lieutenants than they needed.
Just had an over.
I had no assignment for them. So somebody decided that everybody in combat should know how to drive a truck. In case the driver gets off, they can pick it up and keep going. And so they sent junior officers, second lieutenants, right out of OCS to truck driver school. And we got, and well, there were two of us, myself and a guy named Fred Britt from Albemarle, North Carolina. We were chosen by the school to be the instructor for these special groups. Mm-hmm. And our special groups were included WACS. We had the women and we had the officers and some others. But we would get a whole class of 30 second lieutenants. And if you get the picture, here are junior officers just out of OCS, proud as they should be.
I think the best word is cocky.
Well, that's true, too. Except these were seasoned soldiers. They had been through the mill before they went to OCS, and they were a little more mature.
Okay, they weren't the young second lieutenants.
Right. That's right. They knew what the war was about and what the Army was about. But you'd look, take the picture, here's a second lieutenant just out of school. Not only do they send him to truck driver school, which is humiliation, but he was commanded in the school by a private with a set of acting corporal stripes. And we'd fall in with them, we'd ordered them, we'd drilled them, we did. And I don't know if I should say, but if you're familiar with the Army B word, it took on a whole new meaning with those officers.
But they had to go. So, I mean, and you were instructor, and so therefore they had to do what you said.
Oh, we never had Fred and I both. We respected them as they should be.
That's right.
And we knew our place, and we never had any trouble. In fact, it was challenging, but it was funny.
Well, now tell me about the WACS. What's a WACS?
The WACS were... they were brought that they service drivers WACS were brought into. They didn't get into the heavy stuff.
They were ladies, women.
But the small vehicles, the jeeps, the carryalls, they just made excellent service drivers for the camp. And they were good soldiers. Most of them were there because they wanted to make a contribution
to the war effort.
But it was fun. It was fun.
And so you'd have a group of ladies, or you might have a group of second lieutenants, and then you'd have a group of ladies.
Right.
So it was different every day, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But the ladies, you know, it was kind of laid back.
Right. How long did the classes last?
Well, each at a class time, the total program was 9 weeks.
9 weeks, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we went to class, like going to class an hour at a time.
So you had classroom time, and then you had out in the field, you know, watching them drive and things like that.
It was fun with the women. You know, it's kind of pleasant to smell a little perfume paint after you've been through all the work. So it was fun, but we did that for another specialty class we had was submachine gun. We had... I was the instructor for my weapon was a submachine gun, was held by hand, and you shoot from the hip.
Now, was this the Thompson?
Yeah, Thompson submachine gun. And in fact, one of my accomplishments, I've got a little medal on my board that I qualified expert on submachine gun.
And wow.
That's kind of a limited...
It surely is. Those are not easy to shoot.
But we had men come through that were expert. But it fired three shots at a burst. You pull the trigger, it just went brrrr. And then you kind of and you shoot from the hip. But it was a fun weapon to shoot.
And so did you teach, both second lieutenants and the WACs? Or who were you
didn't
teaching?
Didn't teach WACs second. But the rest of them, it was part of the training program. Yes.
Okay.
And... But several things happened. I don't know if we have to. We pulled sergeant duties. I pulled sergeant of the guard. One time when sergeant of the guard, I had a man go AWOL on guard. Didn't leave his post, but he left the guardhouse on his off shift. And when I found out he was gone, of course, the system was that you call for officer of the guard.
Sure.
And when I found out that I was sergeant of the guard, and I called for him, but he wasn't at his post. And so I tried to find him. Nowhere. And finally somebody said they thought he'd gone to the officers' club for a while.
Was this an enlisted man?
An enlisted man that went AWOL.
But you couldn't find your officer of the guard, second
lieutenant.
And he'd gone to the club.
And he wasn't at his post. So I just waited till the next morning when you get through and you go to Miss, you call the guard. I'm down there. I call the guard to order, call them to, and report, and you turn and salute the officer. He's standing way back. And make a report. One guard unaccounted for, sir. And he ordered me front and center, which means you march at attention and you stand at attention. And he asked me, but I said, well, he just left the guardhouse during his off shift. And, man, he lit into me, and he called. He was going to bust me from rank. He's going to court-martial me. And finally, when I had permission to talk, as you say, and I said, well, sir, I followed the book. When I found out I had a man missing, I called for officer of the guard, and he was not at his post.
Uh-oh.
I didn't make it personal. I didn't call in. I just said officer of the guard.
You didn't call him by name. You said officer of the guard.
I just said the officer of the guard was not at his post, and I had no choice but to wait. And then I thought if I'm going to get court-martialed, I'd as well start defending myself now. So I said, furthermore, I am a buck private, $51 a month, wearing a set of acting corporal stripes, and I would like to know what you'd bust me to. And he got silent as death and said, ordered me back to my position, called the guard to attention, and dismissed it. But I often said I would love to read that officer's report, what he wrote up. But I can assure you he got the manual and wrote his report up as though that whole deal had been handled exactly by the book, because I never heard another word from it.
And I can understand. That's the Julius Summers I know doing it by the book. Well, this has been great. And actually, what we're going to do today is, because we have several other items I'd like for you to talk about that are really interesting, we're going to do a second segment. So we're going to end today's program, and there's going to be a part two of Mr. Julius Summers' interview, our World War II veteran, where we're going to talk about this lovely memoir that he wrote entitled Unlikely But True. And we'll finish this up with segment two of True American Heroes for the Record. Well, it's an honor for me to have for segment two Mr. Julius Summer, who is a native of Lincoln County, the Fair River community, and was a veteran of World War II, and served his country in the way his country needed him. We've talked, Mr. Summers and I talked about how, you know, just how unlikely some of the things that happened to him during his time of service, and it's actually in his memoirs that are over in the Military Memorial Museum here in the Old Depot in downtown Brookhaven, which I would encourage people to please go visit. It's open on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and is open to, you know, any senior citizens group or any group from any church or community that would just like to come see the museum, because this museum is not just about the military. It's about our citizens, the people of Lincoln County and Brookhaven during World War I and II and Korea and Vietnam and even the most current things during Desert Storm. But Mr. Summers has got a wonderful little book over there about his personal memoirs, and it's entitled Unlikely But True. And as we were listening to some of the stories he shared with us in the beginning, first segment, it was just interesting how these things, just being in the right line and getting up to the end when there was hundreds of men in line, when he got up to the front of the line, the man at the table assigning them to services was a man married to his first cousin. So it was just interesting how these things happened, Mr. Julius, and thank you for you coming in today and us spending some time together talking about these things that happened in your life. Appreciate you doing this.
Well, it brings back a lot of old memories, good memories.
Yes, it does. And Mr. Summers and I have known each other for an awful long time, went to church together for many years, and I've always admired him and respected him. But even back when I was really having a lot of contact with him, I didn't know about all of this. So this is what we're doing through these programs, is interviewing our vets and having this there for the next generation and the next generation, so we can see how our people, our neighbors in this community, serve their country. So we've been talking about your service in the military. You were telling us a few stories about how you were selected. You ended up in some instructor positions. You were teaching guys, even second lieutenants, and WACS, the female army, ladies who were in the army called WACS, and some of the events that happened there. But, you know, in the middle of that training or that duty you had here in the States, you were reassigned. You were given orders to ship out.
Right.
So let's pick up there, Mr. Summers. You were, you know, tell us how you got that notification and about the group you were ordered to ship out with.
Well, I went in, as I said, service in March of 43, and it is now like mid-44. And the war has progressed to the point that it looks like we're beginning to make good progress toward winning and pushing back. And so...
And let me interrupt you there. I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt you. But, you know, a lot of people don't know a lot about World War II.
Right.
And in the early years, there was no clear-cut evidence that the Allies were going to win.
Oh, no.
The Germans the Japanese had us on our heels.
Yeah, we had tremendous defeats along the way.
Yes, we had uphill battles. That's right. Uphill struggles in dealing with the enemy. But that's right. It's about halfway through the almost 5 years, the tide began to change.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Right. There were two things involved, and the war was looking like it was beginning to wind down, that it was just a matter of time, but it was a long way from being over. And the other thing was they had just had pulled in all the men. They were down to high school. They were pulling the older seniors. My brother, at 17, he joined the Navy, but he liked
at
a
17.
Little bit. And the Navy, on the day he was sworn in, they gave him 2 weeks leave to finish high school.
Goodness.
He graduated high school one day and reported to the Navy the next day.
My goodness.
And so they were getting the troop coming into service were smaller, and the war was looking better. And so there was not need for as many cadre instructors training people as they had. And so we younger cadremen were pulled out and transferred to tactical outfits that were needed a man here and there to build up to full strength for overseas deployment. And so the younger men were pulled out of a truck as cadre, and the older man held on a little longer. But I was pulled out and transferred to a tac outfit pulled my little corporal stripes, and I went to a private replacement truck driver. And 2 weeks after I got there, Captain Steiner, who was our CEO, Captain, called me in and promoted me to technician fifth grade. We called it T5. That's corporal stripes. That's three times I had gotten a set of corporal stripes, but this time I got paid for it.
And a lot of people may hear the word or see the letter T. You weren't a tech sergeant. You were a T5, technician.
That's right. The T is for technician. Technical stuff was driving a truck.
That's right.
But I was a T5, which is the same, it's two stripes with the same pay as a corporal. So I went from a platoon leader, a cadre, a drill instructor, to a truck driver and got a $15 a month raise.
You got a pay raise when promoted you to a corporal.
A $15 a month raise.
Wow.
As I was demoted back to private, same as I was the day I came in the Army. And but from there, we shipped out to get on with it, and we went to Seattle. We had received a PEO post office box number, Seattle, so we knew we were going to the Pacific, and we were shipping out of Seattle. So there's during the war, there was cattle cars. It's another long story that's insignificant, but it's not high-class travel. They took cattle cars that used to, before trucks and highways, they sent cattle to big stockyards and cattle cars. And so the Army made a deal with the railroad to convert those to troop cars. And they just sealed them around the edge and hung some bunks inside. And that's what we got on a troop train of cattle cars and went to Seattle.
Oh, my word.
And to move the story on, we had our normal processing there. And then we loaded out on a ship. We loaded 6 o'clock in the morning, boarded the ship for shipment. And when we got on, it didn't take an expert or sharp eyes to know we had gotten on a rig that was not the Army's best day. Because it was an old British ship manned by merchant marines.
It was not a military.
And so we boarded at 6 o'clock. About noon, we pulled off and headed to sea. And we sailed, I guess, that afternoon and night. And next morning, day, we got up for our regular stuff, calisthenics and that. And we were back in Seattle. Something had happened to the ship that made it unseaworthy, and I had to go back in.
All right, so how many Army guys do you think, personnel were on the ship? Just give me a guess.
I would say 2,500 to 3,000.
Okay. Big ship, but an old rickety ship. A lot of GIs. So most of you probably never been out in the ocean. So here you take off from Seattle, and next thing you know, you're coming back. How did that probably didn't give you a real warm, fuzzy feeling.
That's right. It's never been away from home, much less out to sea. But we got on there, and we came back, and they got repaired. Got repaired and set out, and two or three things. During the voyage, we got in a terrific storm. That thing would roll. It looked like it was just going to go under.
Now, were there any other ships with you, or were you the only ship? You were by yourself. You were not in a convoy.
Nothing else in sight.
Oh, my word.
And so some of the men just actually panicked and had to have tranquilizers. I guess they had to get help to make it. It was scary. And the other thing we had on board were a group of women, civilian women. And rumors around said there was 600. I just couldn't have quite that, but it was several hundred. And we were told or heard that they were civil service government employees going to work in government offices at military bases.
Sound like volunteers.
Yeah, volunteers going. It was an interesting thing. But we had a little protest there because of food. The servicemen, we were in the bottom of, in the hole.
Down in the hole. Okay.
We were in the hole.
That's
at
right.
The bottom of the ship. But the officers and the women were up higher up level. And we were served 2 meals a day, and it wouldn't approach Mama's cooking. But we made it. But the officer then going up, but the galley was down there, and so they'd bring that food out on trays on a big roller of dolly, And we servicemen, we just line up down that hall, and as it came by, they just picked the plate off. By the time it got to the elevator, there was nothing on the tray no more. So caused a little ruckus, and we finally got it settled down, but we got fed a little better and treated a little better after that. But we went and landed at Hawaii. We didn't know where we were going, but we figured out we'd land in a beautiful place. And we were trucked down to the southern end of Oahu to a little army camp of six-man tents, canvas tent, and we were placed there.
Wow.
And the next morning, a captain called us together and explained that we were to be part of a task force made up in Pearl Harbor to go to the invasion of Okinawa. We were set up to invade Okinawa. But we were 2 days late, and we missed that they had a schedule to meet, and so they went off and left us.
And again, that's just another one of those unlikely but true. If the ship hadn't had mechanical problems, you would have been on your way to Okinawa.
That's right.
Which was one of the worst battles of World War II.
Exactly, you know, and I don't know if people like him, you know, Tom Moak, that's well known in this area, was in that invasion.
You didn't run into Tom over there, did you?
No. But he was in Hawaii, of course. He left out of that, but he was a little ahead of me, I guess. Mm-hmm. And my brother Robert's ship was, he put the first wave of Marines into Okinawa, went off my brother's ship. He was on a troop ship.
All right, did you run into Robert in Hawaii?
Oh, yeah.
All right, now tell us that story, because Robert's the younger brother, and he went into the Navy.
Right.
Is that correct? And then
you
ended up running into him in Hawaii. How did that happen?
Well, he was in and out. To put this in play, when we were left, we were just a little company unit, 160 men with no assignment.
No assignment.
And we were just floating. They had to put us somewhere. So they put us to drive. We just did service over. Truck drivers did service driving. Right. And radio operators went to that and so forth. And so during that time, Robert would come through Pearl Harbor transporting ships. And he'd call me one time.
Okay, well, let me do this, Mr. Julius. We're coming to a break.
All right.
And we'll pick this up with you getting to meet with your brother, your younger brother in Hawaii during World War II. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're honored to have with us today a man that's no stranger to Brookhaven or Lincoln County, a good friend of mine, Mr. Julius Summer. And I got to tell you this story. Mr. Summers is one of those humble gentlemen that I admire, just his character. But I have been trying to get him to let me interview him for, what, 2 or 3 years, Mr. Summers?
Since it started. You finally just wore me down.
I just wore you down. No, I didn't. I think some of your buddies kind of put a little pressure on you, too, some of your veteran buddies.
Yes.
And but we do thank you so much for coming in and sharing these memories. And just as we said earlier, this is program two from Mr. Summers. Mr. Summers is like the majority of men and women who served in World War II. Though there were hundreds of thousands and maybe even millions that saw actual combat, it took 7 men to support 1 man in combat. And Mr. Summers, as did millions of others, served their country in a dramatic way during a time when America was really pushed and stretched by this conflict. So your role has been interesting, because these are things that were going on all the years of World War II that people don't think about. They think about the grunts and the dog faces and the guys that were out there on the front lines. But they could not have done what they did had it not been for men like yourself doing what you did. So we ended segment one after a fun trip from Seattle to Hawaii in a rickety old cargo ship. You're in Hawaii now. Tell us a little bit about that, because you actually meet your brother, Rob, your younger brother, who's in the Navy. You do get a chance to visit with him some over there, but tell us a little bit about that experience.
Okay, well, right after we missed invasion group that went down, then they just scattered us all, and we just did driving in case of truck driving. But Robert, Navy transport, he was in and out of Pearl Harbor, but he called me on one occasion the first time.
So he did know you were there.
I mean, he knew where I was, had my address. But he called, and of course I was out, and we missed him on that, but there would be other times. So we just continued that driving just routine daily here, that we knew the island like taxi drivers. We could go anywhere. We'd been everywhere, I guess, on the island. Wasn't that big. But then I came in one afternoon and had a notice to go to the general's office.
Now, this has happened before. The last time it was a colonel, and now you're being summoned to the general's office.
That's right. I got to go to the general's office.
And I can only imagine what's going through your mind.
And so I get there, and it turns out that his chauffeur, this was after the war had ended. We were just waiting for time. But his chauffeur had been discharged. His point system, we got by the points.
That's right.
And he needed a replacement driver. So I was recommended for the slot, but I had to be interviewed personally because he made the final decision. So I found out he was General Powell, a brigadier, one-star general. He was commander of signal forces for the Pacific. He was over all the signal forces in the Pacific field of operation.
Right.
And so I got approved, and I picked up my stuff and moved again to...
Now, I think it's interesting. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think it's interesting because you were telling me this, that up to this point, you were a driver.
Right.
But when you went to work for him, you became a chauffeur.
Right.
A different language because of who you were chauffeuring around.
Right.
A one star, which is a general staff officer.
Right. But I was telling, let me back up just a minute. In between, we had been transferred to, we had been ordered another time, a dodge the bullet twice. As they say, pardon the pun. But we had been ordered again to ship out. And we were loading, we had to pack and loading. We found out later we were being sent to Luzon in the Philippines. Mm. And when the war ended, our commander, captain, was a man about 38, I guess. He had teenage children from New York State, and Captain Steiner. And so he set out to get our orders canceled. And nobody knows what happened, but he got those orders canceled. And again, we stayed in Hawaii. It broke up the outfit, and they scattered us literally on a set.
Weren't you telling me something about you were actually on the pier unloading
the ships? I was on the pier at Pearl Harbor unloading a load of supplies from my truck onto the ship to be shipped out.
And you were going to go with them.
Oh, yes. But Captain Steiner, if we went down under at this time, the war is over, that we'd surely wind up in occupation forces. There was no telling when we'd get home.
Mm.
But somehow he got that order canceled and we stayed in Hawaii.
Unlikely but true.
Unlikely but true.
Amazing.
But I want to tell one little incident that's unbelievable but true. When I broke up, they sent me to Schofield Barracks, and our outfit, nearly all the truck drivers, when they broke up, we just scattered into other islands. And we went to Wahawa, near Wahawa, to Schofield Barracks, which was a fine. And while I was there, the war had ended back in March in Europe. And, you know, they sent some troops from Europe to the Pacific to wind up the fighting there.
That's correct.
And in that transition, the war ended, and somehow 8 men from Europe that I had basic training with back in Crowder and 43.
Oh, my word.
8 men that I took basic with, had training with, wound up back in the same barracks with me.
Unbelievable.
In Schofield Barracks in Hawaii.
Incredible.
Unbelievable. I mean,
that's just with the millions of men that were going all over the place, especially at the end of the war in Europe, and that we're starting to build up to ship all of those excess guys to the Pacific.
That's right.
Incredible.
And I mean, I don't know, you call that more than coincidence. But it was interesting. They didn't talk much about it, as combat soldiers don't.
No.
But they did tell me that Sergeant Hutchison, my motor sergeant back in training school in Crowder, was killed in battle somewhere in Europe.
In Europe.
But it's just a thing that happened back in that same day. So back to the general, when I got there, then he assigned, I was assigned, and he accepted, and I moved from Schofield to the general's house. And that had to be the core of the paradise of Hawaii.
Unlikely but true.
It was at that time the premier army camp, and I suspect still is this day. It was absolutely a flower garden.
You told me the house was like an Annabella mansion.
It was great. It was a camp of a fort of great big old, like Annabellum homes, two-story homes, where the general lived, and his staff. And in the house was there were seven officers, including the general, and there were three enlisted men, a cook, an orderly that kept house for us,
right,
and the driver, chauffeur, which was me, three enlisted men. And but the officers were the general, who had a full colonel, who had two lieutenant colonels, a major, a captain, and a second lieutenant. And we all lived in the same house there together, ate together.
And you told me that they had a party every Tuesday night?
The general had been on our island 12 years. His family was there with him until the war broke out. And of course, they went home.
Right.
But he had a lot of social friends.
Well, just do a lot of civilians.
Yeah, doctors and business people. And once a week, he would have a social gathering at our house.
Amazing.
And it would come in and have all, and of course, the cook did the cooking. The second lieutenant was the host. He was kind of the boy Friday for the general. In fact, he was an enlisted man, but somehow he conned his way into getting a direct, the general gave him a direct commission, made him second lieutenant. But during those social events, of course, we served that. And I was, I guess I would say, maybe I didn't have a title, but I guess maybe I was a kind of glorified waiter or something.
Sure.
I wore a white dress shirt and a black bow tie.
Looked like a waiter.
And I walked around knowing folks wanted something. Could I serve them anything and all that kind of stuff. But that was good duty, and it was fun. And then there are a number of stories from there where I met Robert.
Your brother again.
Brother.
So and it just seems like all through this time, it was unlikely, but it was true, the things that happened to you.
Right.
And I still believe it was, you know, a providence. Now, let's wrap it up because we're right out of time.
Right.
The war, when you finally got discharged, And what was it like coming back home? Had you been home any during the war?
Had never had a furlough.
A furlough, and you were away from home. How long?
3.5 years.
Yeah, my dad served 36 months overseas with one break. That's amazing.
I had one 3-day emergency pass when my mom and family, my sister, had serious surgery, and the Red Cross got me home. But that's, I never had a furlough.
So when you got home, what was it like coming back?
But in front of that, I've got to tell one about Brother Robert. When I was staff driving, we went. I was out on a run and coming in. After the war, the troops were going everywhere, and I pulled. You picked up any military vehicle with a seat in it. You were to stop and pick up service people hitchhiking to go.
Sure.
And I came off a run out. I came by around Pearl Harbor, and this looked like 200 sailors, snow white cloud. And I just pulled up beside them and had an empty staff car. And all got in, could get in. I guess I had four in the back seat and two in the front. But we'd got driven 15 to 20 minutes. And finally, somebody in the back seat recognized me, and my brother Robert and Sonny Smith from Hikes Retreat out there were sitting on the back seat of my car.
Unlikely, but true.
I mean to tell you.
Oh, and, that's true.
So,
well, look, I would love to talk an hour, and Heather's already making signals it's time to cut us here. This has been so interesting, and I'm so grateful for your service. And let me say one more time, Mr. Summers, on behalf of the United States, thank you for your service to your country. You were just like all the other millions. You did what you were told. You ended up where you ended up. And I honestly say the book has got to be, people have got to look at your memoirs over here. The stories are incredible. They're all unlikely but true. Thank you for your service to the country.
Jack, if I could just say one quick. You know, saying that everybody sacrificed for that war.
Sure did.
You know, we talk about the heroes and those who had the hard time.
That's right.
But what about Rosie the Riveter?
That's right.
Had not been for her and others, we wouldn't have had anything to fight.
So
I mean, there wasn't a person in the United States that didn't sacrifice for that war.
It was a national effort.
And everybody deserves credit for it.
It's an honor to have you, Mr. Summers, and it's been a wonderful program, and we thank you for taking the time to come in. So until next week, goodbye.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.